You know, first of all, first and foremost, we got to dedicate this episode to the one and only Cicely Tyson. Cicely Tyson came to the Red Rooster many, many times. And every time I had a chance to sit down and talk to her, it was just an incredible privilege. And I thought about her days as opening the doors in Hollywood, being married to Miles Davis, always setting the standard for Black excellence. We thank you, Miss Cicely Tyson, for everything you've done for us.
Okay.
No, on this side.
Oh, yeah.
The levels are good and everything?
Yeah, those are good.
Okay, cool. No. All right, talk to me. What's up, everybody? My name is Chef Marcus Samuelson. And as you're listening to this moment, you know that my co-pilot and I, Jason Diakite, always talk about our stories, the Black stories, and helping unpacking creativity from the diaspora and how we really articulate ourselves. It goes in so many different ways. Jason being a rapper, me being a chef. I want to talk to you today about The Rise, the cookbook that really talks about Black excellence and that we're not monolithic. You know, there's five original cuisines in America, all stem from the Black diaspora. Low country, Southern, what we refer as to soul food, Cajun, Creole, that both come from New Orleans, and of course, barbecue. When you think about the authorship of American food, Black history is almost written out of it. When we wrote The Rise, the opportunity that Osei, my co-writer and I, was to really to fill in those gaps, to rewrite history, to give true authorship to the people who actually created a big part of America's food, but definitely Black food in America. Black food is definitely not monolithic. You can really experience Black food through immigration. I'm an example of that with Ethiopian roots and Swedish roots, or through the Great Migration, right? Coming from the South, coming up to the North. And today's guest, Kwame Onwuachi, is an amazing chef. And his story goes from Nigeria to the Bronx, to Texas, to Virginia, to the Caribbean, right? Both through Trinidad and Jamaica. So when I talk about that, Kwame is multi-layered, multifaceted. He's an example of what Black excellence can look like today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for tuning into this moment. Today, we have a very distinguished and special guest, the amazing chef Kwame Onwuachi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
More fire.
I'm honored to be here. It's always good to be here.
Kwame, tell us, being a chef, I'm a chef, 2020 is behind us. How was it for you? How did you navigate? You know, how do you feel?
It was tough. I mean, let me just put it straight out there. It was tough, you know, especially in the beginning. You tried to remain strong, tried to hold on, tried to keep going. You know, the buzzword pivot. But it was hard to realize that this is our life and this is what the new normal is going to look like. And it's going to be a long time before it's like, oh, what do you want to do? It's Saturday. Let's go to the movies. Like, you know, like, or like, let's go bar hopping. Like it's going to be a long time before we get back to that. And there was a denial that happened in the beginning. I was like, oh, this thing is going to be over in a couple months. We'll be back to it. Oh, it'll be over in 6 months. We'll be back to it. Oh, we'll just be outside. And then things kept happening. You know what I mean? The realization of racial inequality, you know, and it was like, boom, okay, we're strapped in. The election, okay, we're strapped in. another lockdown, another wave of COVID, and it was like one thing after the other. And that's not even talking about a business aspect of anything. Yeah. That's just being a citizen of the world. We're just watching the news of how we are going to have to live our life moving forward. That was probably the toughest part of it all.
And I'm thinking just for chefs, just like for myself, who's a musician, you know, going on stage kind of needs a live audience to happen. Just like a chef, you know, you need clients, you need diners to serve the food too. How's work been for you? What new avenues has your creativity led you on because of the pandemic?
Well, luckily, you know, I was getting bit by the ownership bug, you know, and I think Chef Marcus can speak to this. When you get to a certain point in your career as a chef, you know, you want to have ownership of every single aspect. You know, you want to have creative control of how people are answering the phones to, like, how, I don't know, a welcome letter looks coming from HR. And if you don't have that full control, then it's never really yours. And if you get to a certain point in your career where your name is on the marquee and the optics look like this is yours 100%, then it needs to feel that way inside. So I was getting to that breaking point as a chef. You know, I started my career really young and I was ready to have complete ownership and complete creative control on how I wanted my restaurants to be. So I got out of the restaurant game like in the beginning of COVID in search for my own restaurant. And I even moved to New York to start my own restaurant. And then obviously the pandemic is still going on right now. So for me, I'd like to say I got out at the right time, but also I had to find other ways to monetize this skill, this craft that I have. So, you know, it shifted more towards brand partnerships and writing, you know, and going more into media and creating, you know, my own platforms for my own voice. And it's that same feels of wanting ownership in the restaurant. I want ownership within my brand now. So it's shifted to outside of those four walls. It's now into the world. And now I'm taking control of the way that I'm being represented in every single sector.
Hold up a second. So Kwame for me is incredible, but he's also great representation of the next generation of chefs. I see a lot of myself in Kwame. We both have lineage and history in Africa. You know, it's just also very different, right? When I was coming up, most chefs, you know, that bad backs worked for a very long time, anonymously, maybe even a little belly. Kwame's fit like an athlete. He's strong. He's handsome like an actor, right? And he can spit, he can rap. You know, he has so many other skills. And he's also incredible sensibilities in terms of the food that he creates. He thinks about how he worked with his mother. You know, they work together sometimes on dishes and that back and forth.
Your mother, a strong Black woman that had to change careers, started a catering company. Tell me a little bit about your mom's catering company and how did you pitch in and, you know, tell me what you were doing coming up.
Yeah, I mean, we had to do everything to help out in the house. You know, it was me, my mom, and my sister. That was it. And so early on, it was a lot of, hey, if you're going to be in this house, you're going to work.
Nice.
So, and I'm like, holy shit, I'm 5 years old. What do you mean I got to work? You know, but it was like, we all have to pitch in. It was like a tribe mentality. So, if you know, there was a bag of onions that need to be chopped for the Trinity that went in a lot of different dishes. And I was chopping all those onions. If I had to peel all the shrimp for shrimp stock, for gumbo and etouffee and things like that, then I had to do that. If I had to take turns stirring the roux, you know, till it got that really nice chocolatey color, I had to jump in and do that no matter how old I was. And I was too young to go out on events. So I would stay home and I would be home with all this like leftover mise en place. And that was really my action figures. That was my Nickelodeon, you know?
Your roots are widespread to both Trinidad, Jamaica, but also Nigeria, Texas. What kind of food did you eat when you grew up? It seems like it could have been any number of fusions and dishes from like egusi soup to jerk chicken, you know?
That's exactly what it was, brother. That's exactly what it was. You know, yeah. It could be anything on a given day. And then my mother was a chef, so then she was inquisitive about other cuisines.
Yeah.
And we'd go out to eat at different restaurants, being, you know, Manhattan was our backyard. So, my grandfather, you know, he's Trinidadian. He just passed away. He's the one who always gives me these expats. Yeah, it's all right. You know, he lived a really, really long, long, great life. And he had cancer, so he was like in a lot of pain. So, but yeah, I mean, he gave me my first introduction to curry goat and roti when I was I remember being in my mom's arm and then him like folding the roti up and putting a piece of goat in there and dipping it in sauce and putting it in my mouth. And it was like this explosion of flavors at a very young age, you know. And then I go to my father's house and it's a goosey soup, you know, which is another explosion of flavors.
A goosey is this amazing sort of watermelon seeds that is toasted off. And maybe it looks like pepitas, like pumpkin seeds. But I just, that bitterness of that soup has and the flavor.
And then you go to the Creole side and it's like gumbo and peel and meat shrimp and etouffee and shrimp Creole. So like, honestly, it could go either way.
I'm really curious to find out about, you were sent to Nigeria at the age of 10. Tell us about that experience, coming from the Bronx and being dropped into Nigeria at the age of 10 must have been mind-blowing.
You know, growing up in the Bronx, it's pretty easy. There's a lot of cards stacked against you to fail. And there's not a lot of fail-safe systems, you know, like other cultures have, you know, where there are people to catch you. And I had my mom, you know, and she was still that peace love. Like, you know, you'll figure it out when you're supposed to figure it out. You're not a horrible person. You're not meant to be in a body bag or a jail cell. We're going to get you right. She actually told me I was going on a 2-week vacation to Nigeria. And I got there and I quickly realized it was not a vacation at all. Actually, like 2 months into it, supposed to come back to go to school. School starts in New York City in like September. I'm like, Ma, what's up? Like, when am I coming back? I get it. 2 weeks stretched a little bit. And she was like, no, son, you're not coming back until you learn respect and learn to appreciate what you have here in America. There's so many opportunities that you're squandering. Even at this age, I was 10 years old. And I had to go to school. I mean, we didn't have electricity. We didn't have running water. We had to walk to school. We wore these like bright uniforms. if you didn't do your homework, you got 7 lashes. If you got into a fight, you had to dig your own height. It was just like, it was a crazy stark contrast to what schooling system in America is, where also I wasn't looked at as the troubled black kid. I was just looked at as a child. Because everyone there is black. So it's like, there wasn't that like, oh, you're the troublemaker. You know, let me watch out for this kid. You know, what teachers would literally say to me and stuff here in America. I wasn't that anymore. So I was able to be free and was able to just genuinely be myself.
Give us a little bit more about the smells, the food, the music. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the most distinct things about West Africa is the smell of it. I don't know how to describe it other than like toasted clay or something.
You know,
like it has this very, very soothing smell as soon as you step off the plane and maybe mixed with a little bit of petroleum or something. I don't know, but it's like the smell is something that I can never forget. This toastiness in the air. And the heat, depending on the day, you know, depending on if it's rainy season or not. But it's like, I think Louisiana is way hotter than Nigeria, I'll tell you that much, because of the humidity. But, you know, the thing that I take away from are the thing that like is singed in my brain are the smiles of people and how they're genuine. And you know, outsiders come in to Nigeria and they look in and they're like, oh, you know, this is how they're living, yada, yada, yada. And for me, it's like, yeah, they've been living like this for centuries. They're fine. They're happy. They actually have a sense of community as well, which we don't have. for the most part in most places. So I think the smiles are so genuine, and people are like, when they're actually happy, they're happy. When they're mad, they're mad. But like, there's this beauty and this symbiotic relationship of the earth to the people there that I can see on their faces daily. And that's the thing that sticks out for me. And that's why I love going back to Nigeria. That's why I love going to Jamaica. You can see that in certain places where people are just so, the earth is happy with the people and the people are happy with the earth. And there's this like, this beautiful relationship between the two.
This moment.
This moment.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Kwame and I also worked recently together on a campaign for Uber Eats where we really highlight Black excellence and Black restaurants and Black chefs. And it's together, you know, we're building towards this Business Matters Matching Fund to drive revenue and broadcast the stories of Black chefs. And it's those type of initiatives that's going to keep that local mom and pop, but also the next generation and the present generations of Black entrepreneurship in the hospitality industry going, because these are tough times.
Can I ask you two, since you're two, Black chefs in America, how noticeable has it been in your respective careers that the expectancy, if you're a Black chef, that you cook Black food? Like, how has it been like stepping outside of that? Like, are you allowed to like, no, I cook, you know, French cuisine, or no, I'm making, you know, like how pigeonholed are you, would you say, you know, by the industry?
Well, I could answer it sort of in two ways, right? Because if you think about the journey of Black chefs up until basically 10, 15 years ago was completely anonymous, right? We did the work, we didn't get the credit. We cooked great food, but that food was never honored or acknowledged or rarely acknowledged in traditional mainstream media. So there was tons of great black cooks and chefs in these establishments like Waldorf Astoria or in famous restaurants, but they were anonymous labor, right? That changed, I think, changed on a couple of levels, right? But I do think it changed with internet because the gatekeeping is just different, right? You know, one of the reasons why I wanted to write The Rise was to do documenting the past, looking at the present, but also acknowledging the future. And Kwame is that. He is the leading young black chef in America. And at some point, you're going to put black in a parenthesis and you're going to put young in parenthesis. And he's going to be the leading chef in America. Right. So he's doing right now. He's getting to that place. And that place is, you know, he's navigating, right? And it's awkward when you go through it. But once he gets there, which he will get to, it's going to be incredible. But my journey couldn't have happened if, you know, civil rights laws, right? I'm in the intersection of immigration and black civil rights laws that changed. So I wouldn't be able to do what I do. But, you know, there were so many incredible black chefs cooking other people's food without getting acknowledged for that. One of the great examples of that is someone like Eric Estelle. He worked at Le Bernardin for 25 years and he's an amazing technician and just now getting that acknowledgement. Now, because of chefs like Kwame, because of chefs like Mashama and so on, I can go through the whole list. Now people can pull up, do their food, have a strong narrative and push it out. And that we're better for that because there's also food writers of colors on the other side. Before you maybe had the chefs, but you didn't have the food writers.
So let's pause that for a second. This moment where we're in right now, where you have incredible like black food editors, writers like Tony Tipton Martin, Usai, you have Don Davis at Bon Appetit, you have chefs out of the Rise, you know, incredible like Rodney Scott, Kwame, Isha, you know, these are chefs that's gonna be one name, household names with America soon. I couldn't imagine this old moment. Such a big, yes, that's a lot going on in the world. There's a lot of negative. But one of the most incredible things that happened over the last 6 months since launching The Rise is the growth of black food in America, the awareness, and I just want to build on that. And I thank the Eduardo Jordans, the Nina Compton, the Melba Wilson, and so on for, you know, locking arms. And we're on a movement and on a journey together.
You know, cooking is just like music. If you're spitting, but there's no hip-hop writers, right, mm-hmm. rock and roll mm-hmm. writers documenting what you're doing, Jason, no one there on the other side. And then there's an audience that doesn't understand it. But I get so passionate about this, I'm just going to fall back and be quiet.
You know, for me, I think people are going to be pigeonholed regardless. That's it. A majority of people see a Korean person that is wearing a chef coat. They're going to think that they're cooking Korean food. That's right. Just it. But you have to cook whatever food you want to cook. Mm-hmm. And you can't let other people's depictions of you guide what you have to do. When I think, do we have to cook the food of our people? No. Is it harder when we don't? Yes. Because you're always defending yourself of why you're cooking this food. And people are always asking, like, how'd you start cooking Italian food? And it's like, oh, man, I spent some time in Italy. I don't know shit. I like to cook Italian food. And you're always defending yourself. But it's not impossible. It's not impossible by any means. You know, I think, you know, Chef Marcus is a great example of that, coming to America and cooking his food and, you know, being the youngest chef in America to ever get a Michelin star, you know? So like, it's not impossible for sure. It's definitely tough. It's tough, you know, but I think anything that's worth having isn't easy.
I looked at Jean-Michel Basquiat and I always thought about what did the art world look like when Michel stepped into it, you know, in the early 80s. And his career was so short. Sometimes I looked at sports, you know, I looked at Yannick Noah or even Arthur Ashe that came before that. And that's how I looked at myself in food. But I knew there was something else. I knew there must have been incredible food in Africa because Africa is much older than Europe. So you kind of have to always hold on to your own idea, your own identity. And I knew I just had, if I got to America, I knew I would eventually find it. And once I got to America and met Edna Lewis, and met Miss Leah Chase and Sylvia Woods, Alberta Wright, the incredible, you know, legacy of majority Black women that were icons in their community. And at the same time, I was also part of this other world, this other chef world, highly male-dominated, white male-dominated, European sensibility. But I didn't want to hide my food. And eventually I left. I left Aquavit, I left Midtown, and came to Harlem. And that's eventually when I came home.
You know, and I want to tell a story. You know, when I started my catering company, I used to try to get out of the projects to like have to get my mind in a different space. So I would go to different restaurants. And one restaurant I would go to all the time was Red Rooster. And I would sit in the corner in the morning, get like a cheddar biscuit, you know, some tea. And I would just watch Chef Marcus conduct his meetings, talk to his staff. And this is when I was like, I don't know, I had to be like 20 years old, 19. And, you know, he would say hello to me. You know, it was a very quick passing. But for me, it was like there wasn't a lot of Black representation in the food media besides him. Or in general that were getting like praise for what they were doing. And I just knew that if I could just see it, I could achieve it. If I can just see him, he's a human being. He has digits, you know, like he has arms, he puts his shoes on just like I do. If he gets up out of his chair, I would watch him eat and be like, okay, he's eating like a regular person. Okay, cool. This is all attainable.
Yeah.
As a young chef coming up. And that for me was probably the biggest motivation ever. Was just seeing the physical person doing something that I aspired to do one day.
Opening Red Rooster, how we did it, it's very important. I wanted the jobs to stay in our community. I wanted the ambitions and dreams to be in our community. And Kwame was one of those young ones that came early and sat and listened and took notes. But it was also about having that open kitchen, because so many Black chefs for generations have worked that anonymous life, just doing and never get acknowledged. So for me, it was important to have a big open kitchen so the staff was seen, so the customer can see who made their food. That could be, you know, the auntie down the street. That could be the person you sit next to on the train. She's a queen at Red Rooster. She's a hero. Acknowledge her. Say hi. Say what's up next time.
Your book, tell us about why and how, and it also is going to become a film. So tell us that journey.
So just to clarify for our listeners, the Kwame's book is called Notes from a Young Black Chef.
So the book, you know, really came about, I used to give these speeches, a lot of motivational speeches, like in the Bronx and in, you know, because especially like 6 years ago, I looked like a high school student. Yes. When I shave, I look like a high school student. So with talking to the youth, you know, they're able to like really understand me a little bit more. And actually, I spoke to a kid at Food and Finance High School that I ended up going to work for you at Red Rooster. And I told him, you know, that he should go there. And if he wants to take his craft seriously, there's a restaurant right in his backyard that he can work at. But one time I did the biggest one, I think it was like 1,000 people. And there was a literary agent in the crowd. And she was like, have you ever thought about writing your story down? And I was like, whoa, how much is it going to cost me? And she was like, I'll get paid till you get paid.
Mama told you right.
She said, how much? I don't get paid till you get paid. I'm like, all right, bet. Let's do it. So I wrote a book proposal and we sold it and it ended up morphing. And the book actually was called Chasing Happiness in the beginning. But then all the realities of America started to come out and like my childhood trauma started to come out and it became this tale of this it wasn't a Cinderella story. It was a real life American story. There's ups and downs. There's lots of failures. There's a little bit of wins, you know? And it morphed into the book that it is today. And then, you know, I got hit up by A24 to turn it into a movie, which is pretty amazing. We start filming in the summertime.
You know, it's really impressive at such a young age that you you know, put that energy into and created your memoir and told your story. You know, that's just obviously that's just the beginning of the story, you know, because it's still ongoing for many more years.
The book is also talking about small wins, but the book is also always on the Red Rooster shelf. Good yeah. company. You got Tony Tipton Martin on that. Mm-hmm. You got some amazing Jessica Harris books on that shelf. So it's a very small, selective Leah Chase. And Carmen
oh, man.
Is by that's far the youngest, but it's holding his weight. It's those heavyweights. So he's doing all right.
I appreciate it. It's an honor to be amongst those people.
This moment.
24 months out.
Mm-hmm.
Where is Kwame? Are you living in LA? Is that restaurant there? Is it in New York? What does it look like? What are we going to call it? Because we're building back. I know we are. So What's in your mind? Project out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I want to get back into the restaurant. I'll probably be in, I think, LA. I'm really, really feeling the West Coast, but we'll see. You know, we don't even know, right?
Yeah.
But what I would like to have a restaurant in LA, I would like to have an Afro-Caribbean restaurant.
Nice.
You know, really, really nice and open, lots of open air. Probably big. You know, at least 200 seats. Bringing that feel of, you know, Afro-Caribbean food in a refined setting where we can finally celebrate our culture while celebrating a special experience. You know, we always have to go out to eat Italian food for an anniversary or French food or this or that. You know, being able to eat our food for our own experiences, I think, is something that's very, very special to me.
I love that progress. I love that desire. I love that keep aiming high. That's the one thing Miss Leah Chase, rest in peace, she always told me, Marcus, aim higher. Always aim high. Mm-hmm. Can I, move closing, can I just ask, what was your grandfather's name? So rest in peace. We're going to dedicate your grandfather.
The one that recently passed away is Winston Phillips. Mm-hmm. He's from Trinidad, yes. from St. James. Mm-hmm. St. James Parish. I recently was able, right before he got diagnosed, to go with him back there. We had a film crew. He showed me his first house. He showed me where he used to play in the canals.
Yeah.
He showed me where, beautiful. You know, where his family grew up eating roti. You know, he took me to where he used to sleep on the beach in Tobago.
Nice.
You know what I mean? I was able to see and walk and have my toes in the same dirt that he trekked as a child. He was very influential to me. He's the one who introduced me to Malcolm X. You know, we recently got Malcolm X tattoos.
Nice.
So yeah. I got it because I was like, man, when you're not around anymore, I want to always have you with me because he sends me these every quarter. And, you know, he's like, I'll always be around. And, you know, unfortunately passed away, but he's always here.
Yes.
Big up Grandpa Winston Phillips.
I just think that, Kwame, you, for me, embody so much what Black food, present and future, will look like. You know, you have ties to Nigeria. What is the food going to look like in the continent? Young chefs in Africa are looking up to you when they see you, and they want to be just like Kwame. Also, here in America, it shows that you can come from the Bronx, you can live your dream, you can be part of food, and you can build it. Thank you for setting the standard. Thank you for setting the example. And this shows that Black excellence lives through food. You're a shining example of it, my brother. I feel like the next wave is going to be from West Africa, where not just West African American chefs are going to start using these incredible things that you find in Ghana and Nigeria, you know, or Senegal. The jollof rice, the soja sauce, you know, these incredible peanut sauces that you find more in Ghana. You know, just to mix it up, because yes, they're out of West Africa, which also means they're part of American cuisine. It's just like, I feel like we got one leg up because we know about it. But the truth is out. The secret is already found. I know the next generation of American chefs will go there. The way we've learned about gochujang from Korean food, or kimchi, or using mirin out of Japan, and so on. And, you know, once American chefs has it, the world will have it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.